Before we begin, we'd like to take a moment to thank some folks. Erica, host of the amazing podcast Southern Fried True Crime, lent us her voice this episode. Southern Fried True Crime is one of the best out there. It's a single narrator podcast telling true crime stories from all over the South. Erica's passion is clear, her compassion is undeniably genuine, and her honesty is a virtue that sets her show apart from many others. We can't recommend Southern Fried True Crime enough. Thank you, Erica. Shay from the outstanding podcast All Crime No Cattle also contributed his voice to the episode. All Crime No Cattle is likewise at the top of the heap of true crime podcasts. It's a conversational style show. Not only are the stories well told with attention to detail and passion, hosts Aaron and Shay also have, inarguably, the best chemistry you'll find in a podcast of any genre. If you're looking for more Texas true crime, All Crime No Cattle is one of the first places we'd send you. Thanks, Shay. We'd also like to thank retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department homicide detective Danny Smith, whose insight you'll hear throughout this episode. Danny is currently a private investigator, has written articles for trade publications, publishes a weekly blog called The Murder Memo, and writes the Dickie Floyd Detective novel series. Danny was kind enough to offer a signed and personalized copy of his first publication, A Good Bunch of Men, to a listener. Stay tuned to the end of the episode for information on how to win that and to listen to Danny Smith talk a little bit about his inspirations for becoming a writer. It's a remarkable story. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are different donation tiers available, including those that enable access to exclusive episodes. We appreciate everyone's support more than we can put into words. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
And serial killers, they're the ones that are most likely to insert themselves into an investigation. And there's numerous cases documented where that's been the case. That does occur, and that they feel an intimacy, you know, to the victim, and they want to be part of it.
After his arrest in 1983 for possession of a deadly weapon, drifter Henry Lee Lucas would be charged with the death and dismemberment of his underaged romantic partner, Becky Powell. Lucas had killed Becky the previous year in what was apparently an argument about Becky's desire to return home to Florida from Texas. The murder took place in Denton County. After confessing to Becky's murder, Lucas began confessing to hundreds upon hundreds of other homicides all over the United States. He confessed to so many, in fact, that the Texas Rangers set up a task force solely committed to investigating his confessions. At least a couple investigators began to grow suspicious of Lucas's confessions, however, and decided to fabricate homicide cases out of thin air to see if Lucas would claim those as well. And he did. Lucas was eventually convicted of a total of 9 murders in Texas. He was sentenced to death for one of those murders, but that sentence was commuted by Governor George W. Bush because Lucas's Florida work records proved that he could have not committed that particular crime. To give Henry Lee Lucas much more time and consideration than this brief and incomplete synopsis seems unnecessary at best, and complicit in continuing his pathetic attempt at writing himself into history at worst. The fact is, unfortunately, that Lucas's name is relevant to Susie Mage's story because her murder is one in which he confessed to. That confession is one of hundreds of bogus claims made by Henry Lee Lucas, claims which not only led law enforcement all over the country on time and money-wasting wild goose chases, but also had some overzealous detectives blindly tainting investigations. While researching Susie's abduction and murder, we'd been seeking insight from a professional law enforcement officer, someone who wasn't previously aware of the case. We thought fresh eyes would help confirm or cast doubts on any notions we've consciously or subconsciously picked up during the hours upon hours of research that we'd conducted. We were fortunate to come into contact with former Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department homicide detective Danny Smith, and even more fortunate that he was immediately intrigued with Susie's case. He told us his initial thoughts on the circumstances of the case and how he, as an investigator, came about them.
The first thing is we're assuming that there was a homicide committed, and that assumption is based on the circumstances because there's no physical evidence that she was murdered. You know, the cause of death is determined to be drowning, so you would think that if she's drowned, that she's going to be forcibly drowned because it's reported that she's an excellent swimmer. I mean, if she had fallen and bumped her head and fallen into the river or whatever, there should be evidence of that injury and some type of indication that, you know, or if she had bonked on the head, there should be indication of that. So the only thing that really makes sense is that she probably was murdered, that she was probably drowned to death. And then if that's the case, who would do that and why? What I gather from the little information I have is that the killer was known to the victim. And basically, I have a couple of thoughts on that. If it's the guy from the Burger King, which seems really, really likely, you know, with the timing of it and the situation being that, you know, she had a responsibility and she is a responsible person, yet she never went back to that laundromat. She's in the Burger King and she's talking to this guy. So she's at least familiar or comfortable enough to talk to this guy. And that makes you think that she's familiar with him. And this is, you know, daytime, broad daylight and, you know, people everywhere. Since no one saw her be abducted, you would think that she probably accepted a ride or for whatever reason went willingly with this guy and then disappeared. So if I were brought in on it right now, that's the thing. The first thing that you do in any cold case investigation is you go through all of the evidence, all of the reports, all of the recordings, all of the files, all of the photographs. You have to go through everything from scratch because you're truly reopening the investigation. And you'd even go out and you'd look at the site, even though it's probably completely different, you know, all these years later, 30 some years later. And after you did that, you would want to talk to any witnesses or people that were involved, former people assigned to the case, anyone who's still available. You'd want to go talk to each and every one of those people. But the biggest thing on a cold case investigation, especially a case like this, you'd want to have a good look at the evidence. And like you said, there's not much there, but make sure that there hasn't been evidence overlooked.
We've already discussed several bizarre circumstances surrounding Susie's murder, but there are more. Susie's father, Dell, told us about an event that took place the weekend before she vanished. The story involves Susie displaying emotions and characteristics that aren't a reflection of her normal, everyday personality.
There was this guy that appeared with tons of money, and he bought this huge estate over there not too far from I-35. He built this huge house, and he had all these expensive cars and stuff. And but his daughter was Susie's age, and they were good friends. Her name was Lisa. And the weekend that sticks in my mind, Susie might have gone over there and spent the night, I think Friday night, but I'm not sure. But anyway, Susie was there, and she was supposed to come home at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and she never came home, and we got concerned about it. And I don't think I was home. I think I was in Dallas working, and Mary got a phone call from Lisa's mom, and she said, Susie's not feeling well. If she's laying down, we'll bring her over after a while. And so all of a sudden, after a while, it turned out to be 6, 7 o'clock, and the mother finally called and said that Susie was in the back of a pickup, and she fell out the back of the pickup, and she wasn't feeling well as a result of that fall. This is like at 3 in the afternoon. And if you were a parent and you had someone else's child fall out of the back of a pickup that wasn't feeling well, what would you do? And you would think you would almost panic and drive her home. But this was stalled for 3 or 4 hours. Anyway, the lady finally brought her home. It was after dark, I think, and after Susie came missing, and we started thinking about the previous weeks and stuff, Mary remembered that when Susie got out of that lady's car, she immediately went through the front door and straight to her bedroom. She didn't even acknowledge to Mary that she'd been hurt, and she shut her door. And even to carry it further, the thing that bothered me, she had two friends named Lisa, and Lisa called after Susie was missing, and I don't know which Lisa, but I'm assuming it was Lisa from the big house near our house. I thought she asked a very strange question. She said, well, if they find the guy that's got her, what do you think they're going to do to him? That was an odd statement for a 12-year-old girl to mention. Awfully strange. Why would you ask that question? And I just wondered if maybe something went on at that big house that possibly this guy, the father, had actually been molesting his own daughter, Lisa, and Susie. And if what's the possibility that he gave her some kind of a mild drug? And that's why she didn't come home at 3 o'clock. She actually eventually came home 7 or 8 o'clock at night because she was semi-conscious. And so when I put all that together, then I thought, what's the possibility that it did occur, and he was afraid that Susie might tell on him, and he actually contracted the guy that was the number one suspect, you know, that told him you can kill that little girl so she never tells. And so all of those things have been in my mind, and I've always wanted to get a hold of that Lisa and actually have someone talk to her about the possibility of if she was ever abused when she was a little girl.
A few days after Susie disappeared, a close friend of hers came to Dell and Mary Mages and told them that the day before, Susie had been upset about a call that she received in which the caller told her that he was going to kill her. The call was later determined to have come from a bar in Dallas called the Habit Hole. Dell also told us the story of a potential witness, though it is difficult to determine whether or not this event could be related. It is incredibly interesting.
The old man, he was loading his boat, and he saw two or three young boys and a girl that appeared to be sleeping or something in the back seat, and he saw them open the door, and one of them ran down to the lake, wet his T-shirt, came back, and was vomiting on her face. And the next morning, when he woke up and he saw it on the front page, he got so upset, he had a severe heart attack. I talked to him months later. They couldn't talk to him for about 14 days. Doctors wouldn't let him. And he said the reason he recognized, was able to describe the car, because he had one just like it a few years earlier, and that the rear left rear quarter panel had quite a bit of damage. And as soon as he told me that, I knew of a guy that hung around that restaurant, and he only lived about maybe a mile from the Burger King, and he had the exact car that they described, and he had the damage on the quarter panel, and I made the point, I never could get the cops to even talk to him, and I made a point. Finally, I went over there with a Polaroid, and I took a picture of that car and drove down and showed it to Kelly and all those cops and said, look, this is the damn car that he described, and it belongs to so-and-so. For some reason, they always dismissed it. Let's say they had nothing. It wasn't Susie, but let's say two or three kids who were there saw that. In the newspaper the next day, it was on television for probably 2 or 3 weeks. Why wouldn't they say, go to the cops or pick up the phone and say, yeah, that was us? But apparently that never happened. The timing he was talking about, I think he said it was around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The timing would have been perfect for her disappearing from the Burger King, and especially if whoever it was said, your mom said for us to bring you home. It was right there by our house that the whole thing happened. It was like less than a quarter mile from our house where the launch ramp was. And so all that made total sense to me.
It isn't clear to Dell whether the police ever took these events seriously or looked into them thoroughly. A woman at a Louisville business reported to have had a peculiar encounter with a man who closely resembled the FBI's composite sketch of the man last seen talking to Susie. She claims that the Tuesday following her disappearance, September 27, 1977, the man came into the establishment in which she worked and purchased several copies of newspapers that bore the sketch on the front page. She immediately called in the encounter to police. Though lack of evidence certainly hampered law enforcement's efforts to find Susie's killer, the notes that Dell lent us and the many conversations with those connected to Susie highlighted several possible persons of interest. There were two in particular that have always stood out. One of these individuals, who we will call James here, quickly showed up on police's radar due to the fact that he seemed to be forcing himself into the investigation efforts, both before and after Susie's body was found. James bombarded law enforcement with offers to ride along with officers, and when they declined, he'd often follow them. He also continually questioned the Denton police about what leads they were following or if they had any suspects in mind. James was known to the Mages as a regular patron of Mary's Natural Food, and it is clearly evident that he would have come into regular contact with Susie, and it's likely that she would have been comfortable speaking with him if he approached her in a public setting. James sought the help of a known Denton private investigator on his own, and though the PI had retired from the title, he told James that he would help if it was at the request of the family. He returned to the retired investigator with the Mage's permission to move forward and, as is apparent from the report we were privy to, proceeded to be an active participant in the private investigator's efforts. James continued to visit Denton police for updates on Susie's case for some time, though it is unknown to us exactly how long. I asked Danny Smith if the behavior exhibited by James was suspicious.
Every homicide detective knows this. I mean, it's, again, it's part of 101, and the reason why, quite frankly, is because of historical cases and serial killers. They're the ones that are most likely to insert themselves into an investigation. And there's numerous cases documented, where that's been the case. That does occur, and that they feel an intimacy, you know, to the victim, and they want to be part of it. It's common.
James's driving narrative was that Susie's homicide was a result of some sort of satanic ritual. Dell Mages ran into James years after Susie's murder. Dell didn't recognize him, but he knew who Dell was immediately. James almost immediately began questioning Dell about Susie's case and told him that he continued to work on the case and asked him if there was any new activity. James, a suspicious character in his own right, seems likely to have been the one who either originally pointed his finger at or added more intense speculation towards another individual, who will be called Stan for our purposes. The private investigator looking into Susie's case concentrated on Stan, who he was very familiar with, for good reason. Before the private investigator was even involved in the case in any sort of official capacity, Susie's case seems to have come to them. The PI's wife recalled the night of Sunday, September 25th, 1977, the night of Susie's abduction, and how quickly their minds turned to the thought of Stan and why.
On that Sunday evening, my husband and I were driving home from watching the football game at a friend's house. We heard on the radio that a Denton girl was abducted. The next afternoon, we were on our way to Skillern's drugstore when we heard the description of the suspect come over the radio. They said it was a Caucasian male in his late 20s to early 30s, about 5'11", light brown hair, with blondish-reddish highlights. My husband and I hesitantly discussed the possibility of it being Stan. We half-jokingly decided that it was a little crazy of us to think that he was involved, even if Stan did make those comments a few weeks earlier about really liking young girls. And the suspect description fit him. After we arrived at the drugstore, and as we were walking to the entrance, we were kind of surprised because Stan and his friends were leaving the store. We stopped to talk to them, and having just had the conversation about him in the car, we carefully gave him our attention. Stan immediately asked if we had heard about Mary's girl. Up until that point, we knew a 12-year-old girl had been abducted, but we had no idea it was Mary's girl. Stan then emphatically added that he was at Kennedy's at 4 p.m. with his friend when another friend came in and told him. When they left, we both commented to each other about the scratches on Stan's hand. particularly the one on his left index finger. There were nicks all around it. We both thought it was strange that he fidgeted with his hands and kept them clasped the entire time he stood there talking to us. On Tuesday, the Denton Record Chronicle released the first composite of the suspect, and we became very concerned due to the resemblance to Stan. When my husband saw him again a week later, Stan was wearing a Band-Aid over the scratch on his left index finger.
Acting on their suspicions, though still not involved in the case, the private investigator continued to ask around about Stan and contemplated phoning a tip in to police, but thought that the evidence was so speculative and grounded in little fact that he decided to hold out. When the FBI released their version of the composite sketch on Wednesday the 28th, the PI and his wife were relieved to see that their suspicions of Stan might have been premature. This new sketch hardly resembled him at all. It was the following Friday, the 30th, that James approached the private investigator. When the PI received confirmation that the Mages family were interested in his help, his first thought was to find out how and why the first composite sketch and the sketch released by the FBI were so different from one another. Upon the hypnosis of Burger King employees who were at the establishment from approximately 2:15 to 3 the day Susie vanished, the private investigator determined that the original sketch was much more likely to be an accurate representation. Photos of Stan were taken with a telephoto lens at Susie Mage's funeral and subsequently showed to an employee at Burger King, who said the photos resembled the man talking to Susie, quote, very much. Another employee would basically say the same thing, noting that Stan's smile was particularly reminiscent of the man. A man acquainted with Stan reported that approximately 2 weeks before Susie was last seen, he was involved in an interesting and disturbing conversation with him.
One night, about 2 weeks before Susie was abducted, I was over at Stan's house off of North Locust Street. Stan and his friend were talking, and the conversation turned to the subject of jailbait. His friend was referring to 15, 16-year-old girls as being jailbait and jokingly said to Stan, "That's about your age, huh, Stan?" Stan replied, "Hell, that's an old lady. I like 'em young, firm, and ripe." In a serious tone, the friend told Stan, "Yeah, one of these days you'll hang in your noose, too." The conversation ended because I said it was getting too bizarre.
The private investigator also claimed to have picked up rumors that Stan and most of the people closely associated with him were practitioners of Satanism. Though we have no way of knowing where or how these rumors came to his attention, it seems that to consider they at least partially came from the person of interest we spoke about before Stan, the individual called James, isn't a careless assumption. Detective Rodriguez of the Fort Worth Police, who often handled so-called occult cases, received an envelope in the mail postmarked September 25, 1989, exactly 12 years after Susie disappeared. Inside the envelope was an article from the newspaper that covered a police seminar in Brownsville, Texas, in which supposed occult activity in the North Texas area was a focal point. At the time that this was received, satanic panic was in full swing and the mass hysteria surrounding the notion that Satanists were sacrificing individuals left and right was likely due to the abundance of violence, murder, and sexual assault that had been building up since the 70s and peaked in the late 80s and early 90s. In the margin of the newspaper article was written something to the effect of, "Stan, if you don't spill your guts about the Susie Mages murder, we will spill them for you." The medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Susie's body determined that there were no signs of sexual assault. There are, however, strong indications that Susie had been redressed. As Danny Smith explained to us, Susie's murder was most likely sexually motivated.
She was dressed, but there was some oddities about that. In other words, it definitely has the markings of being redressed, and then you have to start saying, okay, but why and how? Why would she be undressed? You know, if we know the cause of death is drowning, she is drowned there because they had, parts and particles, gravel, I think it was, that's consistent with where the body was found, that was found in her lungs, as I recall. So it seems like she was drowned there at that location. All of that's really interesting. Because there's no evidence of sexual assault, meaning that the doctor didn't find, you know, the evidence of her having been penetrated doesn't mean that it wasn't a sexual assault. I actually was working on a cold case recently where the killer ejaculated on the victim's stomach. Basically, he pleasured himself and there was no penetration whatsoever. So with her being in the water for 10 days or however long, I'm sure there's no evidence of something like that. But that's something that could have happened, you know, that they wouldn't be able to determine, okay, this is a sexual assault murder. But if it's not a sexual assault murder, then you're really left scratching your head because, okay, well, then why would anyone grab this 12-year-old and kill her? There's a very good chance that he has been involved in other situations where he is sexually assaulted at the very least.
On the next episode of Gone Cold Podcast, we'll talk about Susie Mage's legacy. It's an incredible story that I hope we can convey in a way that doesn't undermine its significance. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Susie Mages, please contact the Dallas Police Department Cold Case Squad at 214-671-3661 or coldcase.dpd@dallascityhall.com. You can also leave tips through the Crime Stoppers hotline at 877-373-8477. As always, we'd like to extend a huge thank you to Susie's father, Dell, for his cooperation and contributions, and for his trust, candidness, and friendship. And again, thanks to Erica of Southern Fried True Crime and Shay of All Crime No Cattle for helping us out with this episode. We highly suggest y'all check these excellent podcasts out. Thanks to our new friend, Danny Smith, who was not only helpful in providing insight into Susie's case, but who also spoke with me about his books and provided a glimpse into how and why a retired LA County Sheriff's Office homicide detective would choose to enter a career in writing.
14 years ago, I retired from the Sheriff's Department, and I retired on a medical injury. I hurt my neck rolling around on the ground with a parolee who had a different agenda than mine. Long story short, I had two neck surgeries and they retired me. But at the time, I tell people it was actually a blessing from God because I was really, really, really burned out. And subsequently, it turns out I was diagnosed with PTSD. My medical doctor said he thought I was depressed. And of course, I started to argue with him because I've been arguing with my wife about that for about 6 months. And I finally realized that I'm being stupid. And I said, yeah, I guess maybe I am. I just keep saying I'm tired and worn out and burned out. But yeah, I think there might be some depression going on here. And he wanted to put me on meds, and I really didn't want to do that. So he said, well, you know, what about some counseling? I said, I'm not the kind of a guy that do very well with counseling. And he talked me into going to see this guy. And he said, you'll like this guy. And I did. I felt like I could really level with him. He sent a questionnaire before I went and met with him that had about 5 questions that were basically, tell us about how you feel and, you know, what about your job may cause stress? Well, I started laughing when I saw that. Long story short, they give you about a quarter of a page to answer each question, and I just set that aside and started typing. And so I go in there with this, like, you know, 15 pages of typewritten answers for his questions, and when I sat down with this guy, he's read through it, and he's like, man, you should be a writer. And I chuckled at that. And I've always enjoyed writing. But here's this guy with all these initials behind his name. He says, no, seriously. He goes, you have a way of writing that is just engaging, and I can't stop reading this stuff. And I said, well, Doc, I said, I just told you the truth there. And I said, you know, because I figured I didn't want to lie and you know, water things down because I don't want to, you know, have this ruin my life. I mean, if I need some help, I want to get it. Anyway, the point is, he said, you know, writing's very therapeutic and you write well. Maybe you should just try that. So while recovering from surgeries, I started writing and I decided to write fiction because I could really just kind of do whatever I wanted and have any outcome that I needed. And it kind of was like living in a fairy tale, and it was very therapeutic, and I enjoyed doing it. The first book I wrote you know, I thought it was a masterpiece. And I went to a couple of conferences and met with editors, and it turns out it was a piece of shit. And I learned a lot from it, though, because these editors, they, you know, scribble all over it and go, you know, okay, you need to learn about the passive word, you know, sentence structure, shit like that. And then I applied myself to learn about creative writing, and I wrote another book, and that book actually turned out really good. And that's the first book I published, called A Good Bunch of Men. And I loosely based the characters on me and my old partner of many, many, many years, primarily because he's a very fun character. I mean, the guy's one of these bigger than life kind of a guys that freaking hilarious, and he's a tough guy, and he's everything that, you know, he's a great character. So I write this book, and I never do anything with it, and I start my PI business and consulting business, and I move on with life. And a couple years ago, I think it's been 3 years ago now, he gets diagnosed with a terminal cancer. And I start going down, spending a lot of time with him. They gave him 6 months to live. And one of the times I was sitting bedside, he says to me, "What do you ever do with our book?" Because that's what I always called it, our book. And I said, "Oh, nothing. Why? What do you mean?" He says, "Well, I'd like my family to be able to read it." And I'm like, "Oh, Jesus Christ." So I dug that thing out and I went through it, wasn't happy with it, but I wanted to get it done before, you know, if he wasn't going to survive this thing. And they'd given him 6 to 12 months to live. So I started hauling ass. I basically rewrote the thing. I mean, the story was the same, but I pretty much, you know, just made it a much better book. And then I published it, self-published, with the intent of just selling like 12 books, actually giving away about 10 books and maybe selling two. And that's what I did. And long story short, it kind of took off because the department I came from, LA County Sheriff's, is a 10,000 sworn personnel department, very, very big department. And the word started spreading through the department and then through LAPD, you know, our adjacent department of another 10,000, and just cops in general, that community, people were spreading the word by mouth. And pretty soon, I mean, the book's selling a lot. So that kind of rekindles my love of writing. And I kind of get back into that. And everyone's saying I need to write a sequel. Well, the best news is my old partner, who I called Floyd, Pretty Boy Floyd was what I named him about 35 years ago. Floyd ends up beating this freaking cancer. It is a super rare, crazy disease that only 20 people in the country had, and the other 19 are dead. And this freaking animal beats it because he's too tough to die, and he's too stubborn and too mean, and he just won't give up. And he actually beats this freaking cancer. People are still scratching their heads. Doctors from all over the country are like, "Oh my God, how do you do this?" And then about 4 months ago, he moved up here and he's my neighbor in Idaho now. So I wrote a second book and a third book. And the thing that people love about it is that partnership, and it's kind of unique because almost all of their books are written with one primary guy, and any relationships are kind of secondary to the story. But truthfully, the partnership and the relationship in this, especially in the first book, is really, really paramount and strong and what cops are going, "Yeah, you know, you really nailed it. You know, no one understands what it's like to have a partner like that," you know, and most cops in some point in their career, they end up having a partner like that, you know, someone that becomes their best friend and their children's godfather and everything else. So it's a cool story. You know, of course, the coolest part that he's up here irritating the shit out of me now. And I just absolutely love that. But that's how I started writing. And, you know, like I tell people and I tell him, you know, it's not for what he went through. I don't know that I ever would have written again because, I mean, I write all the time. I, you know, have to write all kinds of stuff, but not, you know, creative writing. It's, you know, his asking me to get that book published is what rekindled that. And it's just been wonderful. I mean, there's nothing I'd rather do. In fact, I'm putting myself on a 5-year plan of being able to get out of the PI business and just write full time, because that's all I want to do now.
Visit Gone Cold Podcast on Facebook or Twitter for a chance to win a signed personalized copy of Danny's first novel, A Good Bunch of Men, and check our show notes for where to find him and his books. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Thank you.